I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. Hello from the heartland. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. News when it matters and why it matters. Our Smarter series features unique people who help us think and live smarter. We're closing out the month of May. We're about 5 months since the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in America. And we're about 10 weeks since the federal government recommended social distancing guidelines. That's right around the same time that we had our first conversation with Dr. Michael Lin, PhD, MD from Stanford University, focusing on neurobiology and bioengineering. His research team is actively looking at ways to better understand the virus that causes COVID-19. And we've been in touch over the last 10 weeks, and I am so grateful for Dr. Lin's generosity because it is a challenging time, whether you're in journalism or not, to figure out what's what when it comes to this new coronavirus. So let's not hesitate. Here's what we know, and here's what we're still learning about COVID-19 in our second conversation with Dr. Michael Lin. Let's just start off with this one question, and it's a big one, so you can take it any direction that you want. Over the last 10 weeks, what has been the most surprising, most interesting item that you've learned about the virus that causes COVID-19? What's been the most surprising thing to you?
That's a good question. I think the most surprising thing to me is that it's not the virus itself, but how our public health officials have responded to it. I think it's become more and more clear that the virus spreads primarily through the air, through respiratory droplets. And the response of our officials has been both good and bad. The CDC has come around to recommending face coverings for everybody, which is good. And many, many smaller entities, such as towns or counties or states have actually even mandated face coverings in public. So I think that's actually a good thing. It means that those officials are responding to the science by recommending something that's very easy for people to implement, very cheap, and also very effective. But the same topic is also a cause for surprise because we've had on the other end of the response spectrum, people who refuse to believe that masks are useful and, will go as far as protest or even turn to violence to avoid wearing masks. And so I think that's very unfortunate and surprising.
It's been interesting because when we last spoke, it was right around the time that the guidance on wearing masks changed from the CDC. Because initially the CDC came out on the record pretty aggressively saying, you don't need to wear a mask. In fact, right. You could infect yourself if you wear a mask. Right. And we spoke about this at the time because at that time you were very concerned about the news on that. What do you make of such a reversal?
Right. I mean, there are multiple reasons why the CDC may have had that viewpoint. Partly it was science and partly it was politics. I mean, so for a public health entity like the CDC, you know, their recommendations should be based on science, but also based on what they think is most practical for implementation. Early on in the epidemic, they were very concerned that people would go out and talk about masks, especially the N95 respirators, the cup-like masks. And there were not around enough to go around for our healthcare workers. That was a major concern. Also at that time, they weren't very clear themselves on how easily the virus spread through the air. And so they were basically hoping that people would just stick to social distancing guidelines and that would be enough. But I think we've seen since then a series of scientific studies that have shown how easily it can spread through the air. I mean, there's this one very well-known one now that where one person before he showed symptoms who didn't know he was sick gave the virus to about 10 other people in the restaurant. And some of these people were sitting, you know, a table away, so they were not touching things in common. Whereas people sitting in a different part of the restaurant that was not sharing the same air conditioning flow did not get the virus. And so you had new data, new studies such as this one, really pointing out how easily the virus could spread through the air. And so I think what's changed is that CDC has recognized the science. And now the balance between wearing masks and not wearing masks shifts in favor of wearing masks, or at least wearing face coverings to prevent, you know, people who have the disease from unknowingly spreading it. So the CDC has been responsive in that sense, and maybe not as fast as we would have liked. And you know, early on, I think this political need to save face masks for healthcare workers took precedent over the science of, you know, slowing down the transmission.
Well, whatever is the case, we are now in a situation where we're all scrambling to find a mask or create a mask. And we've gone from never, ever wearing a mask to now figuring out how to make masks out of t-shirts.
Right.
And so when some of us feel a little stressed or a little disoriented, this is a good example as to why. We've traveled quickly between these two different points. And one wonders where we'll be in another 10 weeks.
Right. Well, I think things have settled down now. I think our understanding of the virus has gotten to the point where, you know, most doctors understand what, you know, how the virus is transmitted and what can be done. Yeah, I would say an unfortunate aspect of the CDC's initial stance, you know, which was not limited to the CDC. I mean, the World Health Organization shared the same ideas, as did some other, you know, other officials in government. The initial stance of the CDC that face masks were quote unquote not effective led to a lot of people sort of down the chain of command repeating that. And that led to misunderstandings over what the evidence showed. And so you would have doctors who were otherwise well-informed saying, you know, there's no evidence that masks limit spread, or even worse, they might twist that to say that there's evidence that masks don't help when actually there's plenty of evidence that masks do limit transmission. So I think, but now people have seen in the news and the CDC has reversed itself. I think medical understanding has come to a consensus. So I think there won't be a change on this front anymore. It's now just a matter of convincing the public to do as much as possible to limit transmission.
Just picking up off that example that you used about the man in the restaurant transmitting the virus to other people in the restaurant that weren't necessarily sitting at the same table, does that new information give you pause about kind of breaking with these stay-at-home orders and relaxing social distancing?
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing that, I mean, the short answer is it shows to me the importance of being careful. But one can be careful while also relaxing stay-at-home orders or reopening the economy. The way that you know that is to look outside the United States. You know, so countries like Korea and Taiwan, they've never had a full economic shutdown. They've closed their schools, but they've continued the work. What they have done is mandated face mask wearing, and so that's become the basic minimum that everyone has to do there. So they will have meetings with people within 6 feet, sitting right next to each other, but just wearing face masks. And it's been shown to be effective. Korea and Taiwan, until the last week in Korea when there was a minor outbreak, they've suppressed their new numbers of cases to just single digits per day. I think in Taiwan, it's been zero for the last few days. So we know from the experience of other countries that you can go about with your normal business to a large degree if you take proper precautions. That's why I actually think face masks, I'm talking about them like they're magic, but they are kind of magical in the sense that we've had it drilled in our heads that we cannot work, we cannot see each other. If we don't wear face masks and don't, sanitize our hands or objects that we pass between people, it's true, we shouldn't do that. It's too dangerous. But if we take those precautions, good hand hygiene, religious use of face masks, we can do it. And other countries have shown that it's possible. They also have good contact tracing so that when cases do occur, we quickly isolate all the people who might be infected. And, that also prevents the disease from spreading. But the experience of other countries shows that you can have an economy in the middle of a pandemic.
Well, and I think it goes back to your point in your PowerPoint presentation, which is one of the first works that I saw from you. That's why I reached out to book an interview, is that you said, this is not the zombie apocalypse.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons, because there are ways that we can continue to stay open and live our life. We just have to do it in a slightly different way. And that's what I actually want to talk about next. I want to go through a couple of the points that we talked about several weeks ago about the virus, how it behaves, how it transmits, and just see if there's any updates that we could share with our audience. So one of the big things that you talked about last time, and it was so important to me, was that you said that this virus is fragile, that it can be easily killed with soap and water. Does this still hold true?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the virus is, it's a contagious virus, but it's not hard to kill. I think people are realizing that now. We were probably a little more careful than necessary in terms of issuing guidelines about how to kill the virus. We talked about these studies that showed how long the virus lasts on surfaces like cardboard. It has a half-life of 8 hours, which means if you want to get it down to, 1% of the original, you'd have to wait a day. So many people have been aging, for example, their deliveries from Amazon. When we get a delivery from Amazon, we just put it in the garage for a day and then, pick it up the next day. We kick it into the garage at our feet, and then we pick it up with our hands the next day. That's probably actually being overcautious, because these studies, when they measure virus survival on these surfaces, they try to get the virus out of the surface using liquid. It's the equivalent of licking your cardboard. So usually you don't lick your Amazon delivery boxes. So the risk is actually lower than stated in these papers, but we don't know how much lower because we don't do the study where you rub your hands over the box and then lick your hands, for example. So,
sorry. But yes. I have to laugh at that, Dr. Lin, because I do have young children and they do strange things. So, I'll have to watch for that. But no, I haven't yet.
Right. Keep your kids away from Amazon packages. Right. So, anyway, people have been very cautious by hearing these scary facts about the virus. But in reality, the virus, compared to other viruses, is rather fragile. Yeah, and now we know that it's temperature dependent as well. So the hotter it is, the shorter it lives outside. When it's in direct sunlight, it probably will only live an hour or so. I'm not sure if that's a half-life or a tenfold reduction, but that's a number that I got from one of the White House press briefings. And so as warmer weather and more sunshine comes around, it will become harder to transmit outside. And, it's similar to what we see with the flu and other respiratory viruses. So that reduces your risk of transmission somewhat. But, one should still wear face masks, keep your hands clean, keep your objects clean, just in case. Because you don't want to be that statistic, that 1 in 1,000 chance of getting the virus, randomly through encounters outdoors.
So the CDC came out again recently and reemphasized, as you were mentioning, that they think the main way that this virus is transmitted is through person-to-person contact, through these air droplets that we've talked about. That being said,
You know, where are you with wiping things down like your groceries? We talked a little bit about the Amazon boxes. I know those are important to people. They're important in my household, but I mean, right. Do you think that continues as far as grocery items or any other items that you're bringing into your house or coming into contact with?
Yeah, I still do it. I mean, I still will either age objects if they're not perishable, we'll age them for a day, or we'll take out the outer boxes or we'll scrub them down with soap and water. I mean, just a little bit of light soap and water is enough for me. I mean, but again, it's like it's really about reducing your risk. I have some friends, you know, who are doctors who don't bother to do that because they figure the risk is low enough. It, you know, it's something that each person may decide differently. But for me, it's not too much trouble to wash things with soap and water before we put them in a fridge. I just don't want to, I don't want to be the one in 100, you know, statistic of somebody who got virus because they turned their refrigerator into a virus storage unit, you know, so.
Well, we don't want to either. Although I like the concept of aging our Amazon boxes, sort of like cheese, we're aging or fine wine. We're just letting it sit for a little bit before it gets, you know, it gets to be opened. When you talk about half-life of viruses on different surfaces, does that mean exactly what it sounds like, which is that, you know, full life would be the virus is as contagious as it will ever be, and then half-life, it's not? I mean, what exactly does that mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, similar. I mean, half-life just means 50% of the virus is dead, you know, or, you know, no longer able to infect a cell, right? So if the half-life is 8 hours, then in 8 hours, 50% of the original virus has died off. In another 8 hours, that is 16 hours from the original time, then another half of that dies off, so then you're down to 25%. Yeah. So anyway, the half-life is it's a common measure because most things sort of decay with a, you know, with a steady rate, and then you can just measure how, what's half, what's one quarter, what's one eighth.
So with the information that we have right now, the virus is fragile. We'll continue to wipe off some of the objects if we want to be very careful. That hotter weather may be helpful in keeping the transmission not quite as active. How concerned are you about the fall and when we get back into what we would typically describe as flu season?
Yeah, it's going to be back. I think, you know, absent a vaccine, which will take time to implement, even if we got it right away, it will come back. And regarding virus and the environment, you know, I would say being hot and outdoors is better than being cool and indoors, which means as we're coming to the summer, it's much better to be eating a lunch outdoors and away from people than it is to be eating lunch inside a restaurant that's cool and air conditioned and has other people in it. So, you know, I don't know what other states are doing. You know, in California, we're talking about reopening restaurants next week. I'm not sure what the rules are going to be. There's probably going to be some social distancing protocols in place, meaning, you know, a table cannot be more than 6 feet away from other tables, and you can only eat with your household members at one table. Even then, I would be hesitant to sit in the air-conditioned building with other strangers, with my food in front of me and my mouth open, eating it for an hour. You know, that's much riskier than taking the food outside for takeout and then finding a place by yourself outdoors.
That's good advice, I think. Many of us, including many of my friends, family, we're all trying to figure out what's our comfort level with sitting in a restaurant, or what's our comfort level with getting takeout? And there's a lot of bargaining happening, you know, we're comfortable to a certain extent at a certain time, at a certain place, and it's difficult, you know, we're kind of creating a new way, a new routine, and routines create some comfort.
Yeah, it can be kind of anxiety inducing to try to think of it too much. You know, one thing that's, I think, a useful statistic to keep in mind is the active infection rate that's going on around you. So I did a quick calculation based on the number of fatalities that are going on each week. We can calculate what's the number of new infections each week. And since we know that people on average are about infectious for about 1 week, we can then get an idea of how many people out there around you are actively, you know, potential spreaders of the virus. The number I got is 3 in 1,000 for the United States, and 1 in 1,000 for California. So, you know, if you imagine you're in a crowd of 1,000 people, one person might actually be sick and be emitting the virus. So that's a small number, but it's big enough that if you go to a crowded place, it matters. But if you go to a store where 1,000 people might pass through every day, it matters. And things like restaurants and supermarkets are places where people can exchange virus through objects more easily, right? So you imagine a cashier has to touch everything that people have put in their shopping carts all day long. So they could easily touch objects that have been touched by hundreds of other people. And so a cashier, if I were a cashier, I would consider myself working in a high-risk job. And so, and a delivery person as well, they don't have to touch the person they give the packages to, but they have to handle a lot of packages that were touched by people upstream of them. And so in some environments, this 1 in 1,000 or 3 in 1,000 number, is worth thinking about.
Well, and to your point, there's a chance, and there's still a chance. It may not be high necessarily or sound that high, but depending on where you're going and how many people have been there before or after you,
right?
It's something to think about. That kind of leads nicely into our next section of just talking about what's new or what we've learned. And I know your research team is working on, is looking at the virus, looking at ways that we can combat the virus. And so I'm really curious about, again, looking at the virus on a molecular level and getting an understanding for its contagiousness, because we keep on hearing how contagious it is, but then we have these different pictures that have emerged. We have pictures that emerge like this a study that was highlighted by the CDC out of South Korea with fitness classes. And in a fitness class, there was a certain amount of instructors that were able to spread the virus between attendees of a fitness class. But then you have situations where a family, let's say there's one person that comes down with COVID-19 and no one else in the family gets infected, even when they're tested for antibodies,
Right.
So they didn't even, it is not even registering. And that's confusing because if you think, okay, it's a high risk for me to be inside a gym class for 45 minutes breathing heavily. Then what about, running around with my kids inside the house on a rainy day and with a spouse that may have it, but then no one gets it?
Yes.
How do you make sense of that?
Yes. That's a really good question. It's probably, if I had to say it's one mechanism, it's probably based on how much virus the infected person is emitting. And so, we now know, so you asked about what we've learned about the science. We've learned a couple of things since 10 weeks ago. One very important thing is we've learned that asymptomatic people can spread the virus and that the amount of virus peaks, reaches its highest point right at the time that symptoms emerge. And so you can have a day or two when viruses are getting to high levels in your nose and mouth and you don't know you're sick yet. So in a case like the fitness instructor spreading the virus to many people in the gym, maybe that person was at that time before they had symptoms, they were feeling fine, but because they were shouting and breathing hard for an hour, they were creating a lot of droplets, and that causes a super spreader event. In cases where at home you don't get sick from somebody who you live with, that's a lucky situation for those who didn't get sick. It could be that that person, the initially infected person, fought off the virus very effectively before it reached higher levels. So maybe, different people have different levels of viruses. We haven't done enough studies to really understand that very well. But that's one possible mechanism.
That's really interesting. That makes sense to kind of understanding of both knowing how contagious it is, but then not really understanding that game of chance of how it's spread in different communities. And maybe it's just that it is. There's a chance. There's also all these comparisons. Obviously, you've seen these to the flu, because that's the one thing that we know, right? Everyone really knows the flu. But I was reading through some of your research and you said, we have to be careful with looking about mortality rate and comparing it to something like the flu, because we don't necessarily know the infection rate for this. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think that's a really important point to keep in mind as we're still so early in this.
Right. Well, I think there are some things we can say. The flu, we've lived with it so long that, we have some general ideas of what the infection fatality rate of flu is. We also have some general idea of how many people die each year because of the flu and pneumonia caused by the flu. So in the U.S., the figures are for mortality from the flu each year, about 30,000 to 60,000. For the percent of people who get the flu who die from it, most publications will say between 0.05 and 0.1%. So that's 1 in 1,000. Right now with COVID-19, the best data are that between 0.5 and 1% of people who get the disease die of it. So that's about 10 times more lethal than the flu. And that explains why our total death count from COVID-19 in the U.S. is approaching 100,000. So if you compare it to the flu, you know, we had just said the flu is 50,000 a year. 100,000 is twice that of the flu. So it is much worse, and yet only probably less than 5% of the population total in the U.S. has gotten the virus so far. So there's still potential for the numbers to be 20 times worse, which, of course, definitely hope we don't get to.
Let me pause you on that. We actually talked about that a couple weeks ago, just when I called to you mm-hmm. know, annoyingly ask you questions. As a check up on things.
It was a pleasure. Yes.
Well, I always appreciated it. I really needed to talk to someone that I felt could work through a couple of these different theories that were appearing, which mm-hmm. one of them has been that a lot of us have been exposed, that there's some sort of herd immunity happening that maybe we're just not aware of, that, you know, a lot of us are walking around asymptomatic. And when officials say it could be 50% of us, it makes us feel like, well, you know, of that 1,000 people that we're coming into contact with, then half of them have already been exposed. I mean, just in the simple way that we could, you know, think about the math, which is probably not correct based on how the statistics work. But why do you believe statistically, based on the data, that the likelihood of a large percentage of the population somehow having immunity to this or being exposed to this is very unlikely?
Yeah, well, it's very simple. I mean, this idea came out basically as a wishful thinking exercise. And it kind of thrived for a while when there was no data. And it kind of got a little bit of a boost when some incorrect or poorly executed studies were announced. But, you know, basically there was this hope that, well, it's much less lethal than we thought and everyone has already gotten it. If you look at studies where people have looked at seropositivity, right, the presence of antibodies to the virus, in populations that actually, well, anyway, in well-done studies, and the well-done cities examples are New York State, New York City, France. The numbers have shown that about 100 people have been infected for every person who has died. So the infection fatality rate is indeed around 1%. There have been the only quote-unquote evidence to the contrary, and I don't want to use that term because it's really, really badly done studies. The only claims to the contrary have come from studies that have used very, very poor tests, antibody tests, tests that give a lot of false positives, and have measured populations where the underlying infection rate is so low that they're indistinguishable from the false positive rate of the test itself. And then they've just sort of taken that number that they get, which is mostly false positives, and used that number to say, look, there's a higher level of infection in this population than we would have guessed if the infection fatality rate was 1%. And so basically, it's just nonsense in and nonsense out. So, you know, I don't want to get into the details of, I'm happy to get into the details of how the tests are done, but I'm not sure your audience will want to hear it. But, you know, tests are not perfect. They can have false positives and false negatives. And it's basically pointless to use a test that has a false positive rate of, say, 1%. On a population that where the infection rate is less than 1%. I mean, basically, it's just an inappropriate use of a test. And so there has been basically no evidence that the infection fatality rate is lower than, let's say, 0.7%. And as a result, we can deduce that only less than 5% of the U.S. population has been infected. So it's clearly inconvenient. We all wish, you know, that more people were immune, but we just have to be honest with the numbers. Sweden is another example. Sweden saw that they could squeeze by this epidemic by letting it run its course I think they were secretly hoping that the infection fatality rate was lower than initially estimated. But just last week, they announced that indeed, even in Sweden, less than 7% or 9% of the population had antibodies to the virus. And they already have the highest deaths per capita in Northern Europe, so higher than the U.S. So it's not the case that we can let this thing run its course and have an acceptable number of deaths. If we let this thing run its course, we're going to have 10 times more deaths than we've had already.
What makes you optimistic when you look at new research or the potentials for treatment or vaccine? When you just kind of gaze at that horizon, what stands out to you as something that is encouraging when it comes to the research?
Yes, there's a lot of good news on the research front. The thing that will stop the epidemic permanently would be a vaccine. And there are many ways you can make vaccines against viruses, and they're all being tested now. There are many newer ways and some old classic ways. And so far, the evidence has been that everything that has been tried has had some positive response, and not yet any evidence of toxic side effects, which were main concern when development started on vaccines. We don't know yet, however, if the low toxicity of these vaccines is really going to hold true in humans. What they've done is tested them in monkeys, for monkeys that have been given vaccine and then given a virus. And they've just tested the virus. They just tested the vaccine in humans who have not been given the virus. So for ethical reasons, it's very hard to give humans virus on purpose. And so it may be some time before we know for sure that the vaccines are safe when you get challenged by the virus. But so far, the evidence from monkeys has been that there are at least several vaccine candidates that seem effective and safe. And so those vaccine candidates are progressing into human trials. It's possible that within 3 months, we will know whether they are actually effective.
What is the timeline for that? Let's say that the vaccines are showing that they're not having negative effects during these human trials. Mm-hmm. Realistically, not just having a vaccine, but being comfortable using it on children, who are definitely not going to be included in these human trials, at least from what we know. I know the FDA commissioner was talking about some of that in a Senate hearing. They were kind of discussing it opaquely. So I don't want to get too, I actually need to follow up with the FDA and ask exactly what they were talking about. What sort of timeline are we looking at realistically for that to feel fully confident that even that there's no long-term potential negative effects?
Right. I mean, I think what we're looking at is a large a few months for a larger scale safety study, and then a couple of months more after that for a very large scale efficacy study. So because nobody's talking about purposely infecting volunteers, you would have to know whether something is effective and safe. You would have to give it eventually to a large number of people. So after it's passed its initial tests of safety, you give it to more people, and then it has to be a big enough group that you can give half of them a fake vaccine and half of them the real vaccine, and then see whether, just in the natural process of going out and doing your business, whether the people who got the real vaccine are infected and suffer from disease less than those who got the placebo, the fake vaccine. The two groups will know what they got, so then it's a placebo-controlled blinded trial. So we're talking about, for the mid-stage safety and then the final efficacy trial, we're talking about 5 months from now, 5 to 6 months. And even then, if you're probably not going to test it in children first. You'll probably test in adults, and then you'll probably give the vaccine to adults. And then that will cover the most vulnerable populations, since adults do tend to get sick and die from the disease much more so than children. And then eventually, over time, there may be a trial done for children. But I haven't heard of any vaccine trials that are specifically geared for children at this time.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, for obvious reasons. So do you think at least a year before that it hits the market for an actual option for a vaccine? And I was reading that the SARS virus, the original SARS virus, it petered out so that the vaccines that were being worked on, there wasn't a high enough infection rate in the community to actually see if they were working.
Right.
So that doesn't appear to be the case here because we can see that the infection rate is continuing. Is that a concern at all that we would get to a certain point but then get some false assurance simply because the infection rate goes down and there's not enough chance for those folks that are testing it to be infected?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we can that we would have to adjust as the trials go on. I mean, the sad fact is that this infection, this epidemic will continue. You know, in the U.S., it's sort of reached this slow burn, you know, of 0.3% of people per week. In other countries, it's ramping up. And so there will be a need for a vaccine and there will be the chance to test it, I'm predicting. About the timeline, I'm optimistic that there could be something given to the most vulnerable people in the population late this year.
Wow.
Right. But, you know, it will take time to ramp up. And, you know, we would probably do it in phases just to make sure that it is indeed safe, you know, as we administer each batch. And it's also the case that we may have more than one vaccine. You know, the need for the vaccine is so large that it's unlikely that any one company can make enough. And so we will probably have multiple vaccines.
Final two questions for you. One having to do with continuing on this for treatment. What about an antiviral or treatment that looks to kind of just make the infection not quite as bad, sort of like a Tamiflu?
Yes. Right. So that's the other new thing that's happened in the last 10 weeks. So the big news was that remdesivir, which is the lead candidate for an effective antiviral, was proven to be effective and was given emergency approval by the FDA. So the study was finally published in New England Journal of Medicine just last week. And it showed that remdesivir, given to hospitalized patients, would reduce the length of hospitalization by about 30% and also reduce the risk of death by about 30%. And so this was a randomized, blinded, placebo-controlled trial. So So that you know, assures that the patients are treated exactly the same, whether or not they were given the drug or the placebo. So it's very strong evidence that it does work. Now, 30% is not, of course, a cure. You can call that a modest improvement, but it's certainly important for those who do recover faster or survive because of the drug. There are other antivirals being tested. Remdesivir is an inhibitor of the enzyme that the virus uses to replicate itself. There's another drug that also works against that virus. It's being tested in Japan. It's actually a drug made by a Japanese company and was already approved there as a flu treatment, and now it's being tested as a COVID-19 treatment. And you know, there are other drugs that are close to the end of development, that could be entered into human trials soon. Although they're probably not going to make it in time before a vaccine takes hold. So the window of opportunity for new drugs is actually fairly small. Remdesivir was convenient because it was already being tested in Ebola virus. And so we had already had all the safety information we needed on it. So that's why it was able to be approved so quickly.
Well, it sounds like you feel somewhat optimistic about there being a treatment, at least not in the far, far future, which I think most of us will take for right now, just to know that there's something out there that could be helpful. There's many that also feel worried about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So I don't want to forget that. I want to balance that with the treatments. Just a final question for you. You know, I know you have a lot of big titles, PhD, MD, but another important title you have is as a father. And I'm just curious about how you're feeling about the school year. And that's made a lot of news recently. A lot of our audience is really concerned about that. Mm-hmm. And I just was curious your thoughts in general about kids going to school and impacting not just infection rates amongst kids, but their parents and the community overall.
Yes, I think it's, you know, I think the epidemic has really bifurcated people's experience depending on whether they have kids or not. Because
it's true.
You read these articles where people say, oh, you know, here's the movies you can watch. If you watch everything else, you could have watched already. I'm like, who are these people? I mean, they clearly don't have kids, right? Because, you know, if you have kids and a job, you now have two jobs. And, it's created a lot of stress for working families with children. You know, in our neck of the woods here, I don't know, actually, if the school district has decided what's going to happen in the fall. Assuming that the virus is still around, which is likely it's going to be, then I think it's looking like at least another quarter or semester of online instruction. And so that's highly time consuming and stressful for parents. And yeah, I don't think there's a good solution. This is something that's quite difficult. So I think it's going to be a summer of family vacations, of families getting to know each other better. In some ways it's good, but certainly it's a major inconvenience when it comes to work.
Yeah, well, in some cases it's nice to talk to someone that has the background that you do that says, listen, actually, we're not quite sure. You know, like there's not really one clear answer right now.
You know, in the old days you'd had your grandparents. You know, you have three generations living on the roof. And so the parents could work while the grandparents took care of the kids. So, you know, it would actually be a good argument for extended families getting back in touch and helping each other.
That's true.
You just have to make sure that everybody within your extended family, you know, sticks to good practices when it comes to limiting transmission of the virus. But, you know, that's one possible solution.
And that's getting us into a whole new area where I actually thought this week, Dr. Lynn, I thought I'm going to have to interview a family therapist because I think not only are we trying to navigate what does this virus look like, but different families have a lot of different opinions about how they're managing this and it's causing a lot of friction. But maybe there's a good family therapist at Stanford that you know that I could talk to about that. We'll round out the conversation. But thank you, Dr. Lynn. It's always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news, a refuge from the storm. I'm Jenna. Thank you for choosing smarter.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.